Welcome to Holden Village, and today is July 31st of 1995. In the fireside room this morning, we have Paul Bosch, and he's going to be lecturing on worship and its arts, architectural. So now let's tune in on Paul as he starts his lecture.
Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation. O my soul, praise Him, for He is your health and salvation. Let all who hear now to His temple draw near, joining in glad adoration.
Fourth stanza.
Praise to the Lord, O let all that is in me adore Him. All that has life and breath come now with praises before Him. Let the Amen sound from His people again, gladly forever adore Him.
That's the best hymn in the book, as far as I'm concerned. That's been my favorite for a long, long time. That's marvelous. Well, roll the tape. Tape people, I have to tell that to the people in the booth. My name is Paul Bosch. The title of this session is Worship and Its Arts, Architecture. It's one of a series of four this week, all of them at this hour, unfortunately. You have to choose between eating early and coming to this session. If you're really hungry, why, then you miss this session. But 11:50 on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, we'll be taking up four of the important arts of worship. Today, architecture. On Wednesday, action and drama and gesture. On Friday, poetry and words. And on Saturday, signs and symbols and what I call artifacts. This has been my interest since before... Well, since I was a little kid, all of the arts. Architecture, drama, painting, singing, all of those things. I haven't put singing into my series this week because there are musicians who do that during the week. So I've left out hymnody, but I teach courses like that at seminary. I teach courses in church architecture at seminary. I teach courses in church drama. And I even teach one course. It's the whole spectrum of the arts. And that's what you're getting this week, if you stick with me. You don't have to stick with me. Each session is independent, but it would be kind of fun to see you all together all through the week. I should say that we're actually going to practice what we preach, and I have permission from the authorities to push the furniture around in the village center. And I want to have a little crew of people. I'm making an announcement at both settings of lunch today. I need some strong backs to help us push those benches and platforms and so on and make a new architectural arrangement for worship. And if any of you would like to be that, be part of that, I would be delighted. That'll be from 3 to 4 this afternoon. We want even to move in that marvelous Arnold Slotin altar. Are any of the old-time Holden Village people? And have you known that, the altar that sits out here by the coffee place? Arnold Slotin, I think he taught at St. Olaf, did he? But I mean, he's one of the countries, one of the world. I mean, he has an international reputation as a fine, fine sculpture, particularly in wood. And he did that altar out of railroad ties from the mine. And he did the lectern pulpit reading desk as well. And I'd like to put that in the place of the other one. So that'll be at 3 to 4 this afternoon. If you want to be part of that, I would be delighted. You might also want to... Oh, big trouble. You might also want to take a look at these books in the bookstore. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry is a document put out by the World Council of Churches only recently. Our own Lutheran, Bill Lazarus, has had a big hand in writing it, preparing it, and it represents a really thrilling consensus, an agreement, a convergence among all the churches, and here they're represented. Listen to this. Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, Presbyterian, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptism, Adventist, and Pentecostal. Can you imagine? Last week my sessions were entirely on this document. Baptism, agreement about what baptism means. Eucharist, Holy Communion, agreement about what Holy Communion means and how we ought to celebrate it. And even ministry, what ministry means. Terrific ecumenical convergence, agreement, consensus, such as we have not seen since before the Reformation. Then also in the bookstore is my little book, just published. It's one, volume two of a series, Open Questions in Worship. And this volume is What is Contemporary Worship? And I have been a contributor to that volume. So you might want to pick up both of them. They're both overpriced, I'm sorry to say, but aren't all books these days. Boy, terrible.
Paul, what was volume one?
Volume one was called What Are the Essentials in Christian Worship? And they have volume one there as well. As a matter of fact, they have volume three, which has just been published, How Does Worship Evangelize?
They don't have volume three.
Have you seen volume three?
No, I went in and asked for it.
They ran out?
On Friday, they didn't have it, yeah.
Oh, pity. They had it advertised, you know, last week They had it there. It may be that they've sold them all out. In any case, let me quickly recapitulate what that ecumenical consensus might include. I have noted that these are our standards, biblical Jewish, that is our worship and our faith generally, our theology, our practice, our church structure even, ought to have some relation to the Bible and to our Jewish antecedents. We're all honorary Jews, Christian Stendhal says. It's Catholic in the sense of being ecumenical, universal, whole, complete, lacking nothing in its parts. Non-sectarian, Trinitarian, that's all Catholic. Catholic small c. Even the Roman Catholics are judged by the Catholic consensus. And the Catholic consensus that you can see here, I mean, how much more Catholic can you get? Catholic in the sense of universal. Trinitarian, non-sectarian, complete, whole. Confessional, flavor in the soup. Roman Catholics are Catholics who happen to be Roman. Lutherans are Catholics who happen to be Lutheran. Methodists are Catholics who happen to be Methodists. That kind of thing. I mean, that's what I would like to think. That's the confessional flavor in the soup. I like to think that Lutherans have a gift that they can give to the ecumenical treasury, and Methodists have a gift, and Presbyterians have a gift, and Anglicans, Episcopalians have a gift, and so on. That's the confessional level, national, parochial, and personal. I won't go into much more of that. But do let me take a look for a moment at the contemporary spirit, and that's in my little pamphlet here. I spell that out in relatively sketchy form, but let me try to amplify that. A lot of people have been puzzled in the last 20, 30 years about quote-unquote modern art. What is modern art or modern architecture? And what is it trying to say? And how is it different from the art or the architecture or the poetry, for that matter, or the music that we used to have? Well, we could sketch out, and I will in a few minutes, a history of architecture, and that history is pretty much paralleled in some of the other arts. I suppose we have moved out of a kind of Victorian sensibility at the end of the last century and the beginning of this century. I would date the modern movement, the quote-unquote contemporary movement in art, architecture, music, literature, from about 1912. About 1912, things began to happen. Among other things, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was first performed, I think in Paris, and there were riots in the streets. Modern music. Do you know the Rite of Spring? Did you see Walt Disney's Fantasia? The dinosaur part. Jum, 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 jum. Remember all that? Oh boy. He had a 5-4 meter at one place, or 5-4 rhythm. I mean, it was very difficult to play, apparently, and difficult for modern people to assimilate and understand. Now it doesn't sound so shocking, but back in 1912 it sounded very shocking. Also in 1912 was the date of the so-called Armory Show in St. Louis. St. Louis, Missouri, was the site of an armory, and they had an art exhibit there that introduced North Americans to Picasso and Braque and Matisse and the modern Cubist and other modern artists. And again, people were rioting in the streets over that show because it was so unusual. They'd never seen art like this, paintings. What I'm trying to say is that in music and in painting and, of course, in architecture, the Bauhaus School, the so-called International School of Architecture, all of these arts began to converge and began to come up with a single voice. And that single voice has been called the modern, quote-unquote, movement. You should know, for whatever it's worth, that we are in now the so-called postmodern age or postmodern era. And so some of this consensus that ruled the world, really, in all of the arts from about 1912 to maybe 1970, 1975, that was a modern consensus, the contemporary spirit in art. And as I say, Ernest Hemingway in literature and Stravinsky in music and the Bauhaus School in architecture, and Picasso in painting. I mean, you could go down the list and you could see these realities that were all endorsed by the so-called modern movement in the arts, contemporary movement. First of all, not romance, but reality. And literature particularly, but in music as well, and some of the other arts, art forms, there was a rejection, shortly after the turn of the century, a rejection of Victorian excess. Victorian architecture, you know, is all the gingerbread and the barge boards and all the fancy turnings and spindles and dowels and jigsaw stuff and so on. I kind of like Victorian, as a matter of fact, and my house is full of Victorian furniture, and I owned a Victorian house until a couple of years ago. There's a lot of exuberance in that Victorian stuff, partly, I think, technologically based. That is to say, the Industrial Revolution brought in for the first time now a power jigsaw and a power lathe, powered by electricity. And the Victorians were exploiting what they could do with a lathe and what they could do with a jigsaw. So you had all this wonderful, exuberant decoration in Victorian furniture and Victorian architecture. And it was very exuberant. Now, the same thing in literature, the same thing in music. Exuberance and heartfelt emotion and passion, purple passion, and prolix, I mean, a lot of words, and a lot of adjectives in literature, for instance. Along comes Ernest Hemingway, again, the modern spirit, and his novels and his writing, again, a lot of it is macho posturing in terms of the content, but in terms of the style, it is very austere. Nouns and verbs. No adjectives, no adverbs. Very much like biblical language, for that matter. Some of the Bible is kind of purple and romantic in its wording, but much of it is very austere. The Hebrew language is specifically austere. Lots of verbs, lots of nouns. Read the story of Abraham and Isaac sometime and see how the author could be tempted to purple passion. You know, here's this nice little boy going to be killed by his father. But you don't get any of that. Abraham stretches forth his hand, he takes the knife. I mean, it's wonderful, spare literature, very, very austere and simple, in an attempt to reject all the purple excesses of the Victorian era. Modern writers, like Ernest Hemingway, are austere and simple. Modern architecture, from the International School and the skyscrapers now that are in every city in Western civilization and in some in Eastern civilization as well. Glass boxes or stone or steel towers with a skin of, you can build a building now, you see, with a steel skeleton, and the walls are just curtains. So you can have glass walls. They don't support anything. I took a wonderful architectural tour of Chicago the Loop in Chicago a couple years ago, a walking tour of the Loop. And Chicago is where the skyscraper was invented. You apparently can go up about 12 stories if you're building stone on stone or brick on brick. But above 12 stories, the walls have to be too thick to support all that, and so it's not practical. But if you have a steel framework, you can go up hundreds of stories. And the World Trade Tower in New York City and the Sears Tower now in Chicago, I mean, they are immensely tall buildings. And the steel skeleton holds it up, and the walls are just skin. They're just curtains. And when in the architectural tour, here were two buildings across the street from each other. This was brick on brick, stone on stone, 12 stories. Here was the first skyscraper, also 12 stories, but with a steel skeleton. Very interesting. And then they went on from 12 stories, you know, to the stratosphere. Frank Lloyd Wright had a plan for a mile-high building. It never got built, but he thought it could work. Anyhow, not romance, not all that Victorian excess, not all that purple passion, either in music or architecture or whatever art form, but rather simple reality. Which brings us to less is more. That is a theme or a watchword of, again, the International School of Architects, Mies van der Rohe and Corbusier and Marcel Breuer and these people who built buildings from 1912, 1920 into our own time. And they're very austere, very simple. The less you say, the more you say. I mean within limits. That was their watchword. Let's have everything stripped down to its essentials. And oh, some of the buildings I think are very, very splendid. They are so very, very simple and so very, very elemental as to affect me anyhow. And I think they're great. And if you know the Whitney Museum in New York City or St. John's Collegeville, and it's an Abbey Church that's marvelous, marvelous building. Corbusier's chapel in France at Ronchamp. Marvelous building. I mean, some of them are very, very splendid, and they are very simple, austere. Which brings us... Interrupt, yeah.
Are we not moving a little bit to a refinement, maybe, in Atlanta?
Ah.
Those austere buildings are no longer rectangles.
Ah.
There's, you know, a little...
They're embroidering them a little bit.
And it's visually very interesting.
Uh-huh.
They must be identical inside.
Ah.
But they no longer have that just plain austerity.
I see. Maybe what you're describing is the so-called postmodern architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And what's his name? Philip Johnson scandalized the architectural world. I've got a bone spur. Have any of you had a bone spur on your heel? It's very painful. I limp around if I've been sitting for a few minutes. Philip Johnson is a great architect, and he's done some marvelous buildings, but he built a building in New York City with a broken pediment at the top, if you can imagine. That's a broken pediment. I mean, that was the first postmodern building. And since then, Pittsburgh Glass in Pittsburgh has crenellations like a little Gothic, you know, it has little towers with peaks on them, like a Gothic town hall or something. I mean, it's really kind of bizarre. And my feeling is that the so-called postmodern movement has not found a voice. I mean, it's a little bit of this, it's a little bit of that. It's Renaissance. It's neo-Victorian even. Edward Durrell Stone, do you know any of his buildings? Lots of little decoration and decorative type stuff. That's almost neo-Victorian. And in literature, John Updike, for instance, I mean, his prose is practically Baroque. Lots of adjectives and wonderful metaphors and so on, very much unlike Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway is kind of old-fashioned now, because we're in the so-called postmodern period. How can you be postmodern? I hope they find a better word. Maybe modern was the wrong word. You know, it's only modern for, 60 years, 80 years. But I'm here to tell you that it was a consensus. It was a very thrilling cultural consensus in all of the art forms
architect. Streamlined trains.
Streamlined trains, exactly, right. That began Art Deco and so on, right. That was the beginning of it.
I certainly agree with you about the St. John's College Hill being a marvelous structure. It is. It's one of my favorite churches.
Yeah, me too. Have you seen his building in Muskegon, Michigan? St. Francis de Sales Church?
No.
Oh, wonderful. It's even nicer.
I simply wanted to comment on that because one of the things that I remember finding intriguing about that is that while it's concrete, mm-hmm. it was not built the way contemporary concrete buildings are with steel forms, but rather with rough-hewn wood for forms, so that in the concrete you see the
grain. You see the print of the wood, yeah, you see the grain, yeah, neat, neat. Now, I think
which is real interesting. It is a less is more, except when you get up close, there's more.
There's texture. Oh, yeah, right. And he's very conscious of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's just marvelous. Now, it's also triumphalist, and we're going to get to that in a few minutes. That is to say, it's a big scale. And I argue in here that there is an optimum size for a church building. If it needs a PA system, it's too big. I'm not the only one who says that. Others say it too. And you need a PA system, unfortunately, in St. John's Collegeville. Sometime go to Muskegon, Michigan, though, and look up St. Francis de Sales Church. Oh, marvelous. There's an illusion that he creates that just blows your mind when you're standing at the altar.
What's the relationship?
That's also Marcel Breuer.
Yeah. What's the relationship between Art Deco and the modern?
Yeah, Art Deco is the hinge. Art Nouveau. Have you ever been to Paris and seen the subway railings and the subway lamps? That's Art Nouveau. It's cast iron, I think. Any of you been to Paris? Raise your hand. The cast iron railings at the entrance to the Paris Metro are all Art Nouveau. They are swirls of, again, cast iron, but swirls of vines and leaves and grapes and so on. And the lamppost comes up in a great swirl, and the bulb looks like a flower about to bloom. I mean, it is the weirdest and most wonderful stuff, but it's Victorian. It's definitely Victorian. Then Art Deco is the hinge. That's the next movement. And Art Deco is the Emerald City and the Wizard of Oz. Did you see the movie, The Wizard of Oz? That's all Art Deco. And that would have been popular 1920, 1930. More geometric than Art Nouveau. Art Nouveau, Tiffany is Art Nouveau. Anyhow, Art Deco is a little more geometric and not quite so exuberant. With vines and tendrils and leaves and all that, you're not apt in Art Deco. You're not apt to find organic themes like leaves and vines and tendrils and plants and flowers and so on. You're more likely to see geometric stuff. I'll tell you what's another Art Deco building: the City Hall of Buffalo, New York, where I was born. As a matter of fact, is Art Deco. There are a couple in New York City that are notable. Some other cities as well, too. Well, let's move on. But I want to take questions, you know, and comments, and even challenges. I mean, you can challenge me. Form follows function. Again, that would be from the Bauhaus School, the International School of Architecture. They said, if you're going to build something, or write something, or compose music, or whatever, the form that you end up with ought to reveal and enhance the function. I had a friend who says, the destiny of a hammer is to pound things. The destiny of a plier is to grab things. And there the form follows the function. So in buildings, so in other areas of our life, this is all part of the modern spirit now, the contemporary sensibility, let us say. They wanted to build buildings, design chairs, whatever, so as to let the form reveal and also even invite the function. So Aris Aaron, and he's another great architect from the modern movement, he goes into a room and he looks around and he says, I saw a slum of chair legs. And he didn't like all those chair legs. So he invents and designs a pedestal chair Have you ever seen the Saarinen pedestal chair? It's white, usually, cast aluminum, and it's got this elegant pedestal that looks like it, again, grows out of the floor almost. That's Eero Saarinen. Charles Ames, another famous designer, designs the potato chip chair. Have you seen a potato chip chair? That's molded, again, you couldn't do it without modern technology. It's molded plywood in a beautiful double curve. It curves this way, and it also curves this way in the back, and then the seat is a beautiful double curve this way and this way, and there's a little aluminum or stainless steel frame, and that's the famous potato chip chair of Charles Ames. And a chair, you see, according to the Hebrew understanding of things, ought to be something that you can sit on. It's very Hebrew. Here, there's a difference between what I would call Greek ideal of beauty and Hebrew ideal of beauty. The Hebrew understanding of beauty would be functional. The Greek would be idealistic. And for the Greek, they have this thing between substance and accidents, as you may know. As a matter of fact, the old notion of Holy Communion was based on substance and accidents, transubstantiation. Let's take a look at this chair again. For the Greek, this chair is beautiful insofar as the substance and the accidents agree. The substance of the chair is its chairness and the ideal of chair that is in the mind of God, you might say. The accidents of the chair are the fact that it's made out of oak and it's so high and so wide and it's got brass nails and it's got a upholstered seat and so on. All of that is the accidents of the chair, according to the Greeks. But the substance of the chair is that in the mind of God, this reveals or somehow approximates the heavenly ideal of what a chair ought to be. Michelangelo's David, the Greek sculptures, all of them are ideal. They try to approximate some heavenly ideal. And again, in the case of the Holy Communion, for instance, the substance of the bread, let us say, changes presumably to the body of Christ, but the accidents still look like bread. That's the old Roman Catholic way of talking about Holy Communion. They don't speak that way anymore. The Hebrews, they say a chair is something you should sit on. So Saarinen's chair with the pedestal is perfectly legitimate. Barbra Streisand's nose. You won't see Barbra Streisand's nose on a Greek sculpture, let me tell you. But boy, can she sing through it. You know what I mean? I mean, she's got a lovely voice, and that nose is part of it, I'm sure. If she had her nose, she's had opportunities to have her nose operated on, and she's turned them all down. And I think it's made a difference in her singing. You know, she can sing with that nose. And form follows function.
Now, I have a question on form follows function.
Go ahead.
The function is a church service. The forms are the traditional long churches or the churches in the round that we now have in California. There are two different ways.
Two different ways. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
All right, I'll wait.
Okay. Let's move on quickly. The medium is the message. This is Marshall McLuhan, Canadian media specialist. I wouldn't say the medium is the message, but I would say the medium is a big part of the message. That all of the nonverbal stuff communicates. A lot of times we Western civilization people, and North Europeans and so on, we think in terms of left brain all the time, and words, and lineal type thought and all that. I gave this statistic last week, and I'll give it over again. 55% of everything you learn about me when you first meet me is nonverbal. In other words, how I stand, how I move, whether I smile or whether I frown, all that stuff is nonverbal. How I dress, all of that stuff is nonverbal. On top of that, 38% is still not words, but what they call vocal. In other words, do I speak loud? Do I whisper softly? Do I speak fast? Do I speak slowly? All of that is vocal, and it has to do with like training a puppy. Bad dog.
Yeah.
You know, the dog doesn't speak English, but the dog knows you're mad. Or a baby. That's vocal. What's left? 7%. 7%, dear friends, is the words I use, the actual content of the words I use. Now, as you get to know me, that 7% increases and these others decrease, I'm sure. But I think that's significant. This comes out of the social sciences. Is simply to say that when you come to worship, the architecture of the building, the vestments of the minister, the smile on the face of the usher, all of that communicates.
Evangelists tell you the first, 10 minutes or something?
Is what makes the difference. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we have been very unconscious of this 93%. And Marshall McLuhan says, don't be unconscious of it. It's part of the message. And that's when we get down here, radial versus axial. Finally, out of apathy into insight. Again, you'll find modern art and the modern sensibility willing to shock, willing to be offensive even, willing to use profanity or nudity or whatever, because we are bombarded on every side with music and visual images and so on, and we have learned to tune it all out. You go to the dentist's office and they got Muzak playing. You go to the checkout line in the supermarket and they got Muzak playing. You go in the elevator in the skyscraper and they got Muzak playing, right? What do you learn when you're bombarded with that kind of stuff? You learn to tune out, absolutely.
There's such a thing known as white sound.
Yes, white sound, right. And it's just part of your environment and you don't pay any attention to it anymore.
Won't you appreciate more silence and quiet and calmness?
Exactly. And I think maybe the church ought to be a refuge from that kind of stuff. Wouldn't you agree?
Well,
I mean, at least to a degree.
Okay.
Again, I'm willing to qualify some of my outrageous statements. But modern people have learned to tune out. And had to become very cynical. That's another price you pay. We are very cynical then. We're bombarded on television with visual images, and most of them are commercial in intent, right? They want to sell us something. And so we get very cynical and very skeptical, and no wonder our politicians, we think of our politicians and now these days too our clergy sometimes as a bunch of snake oil salesmen. Television clergy particularly. They had a talk show in Canada, you know, after the Tammy Faye Baker and Jimmy Baker scandal and the Jimmy Swagger scandal and so on. And it was one of these call-in talk shows. Have these scandals weakened your faith in the television evangelists? And caller after caller phoned in and said, I never trusted those people in the first place. They're a bunch of snake oil salesmen. I mean, oh, were they ever cynical? Anyhow, in the face of all that cynicism and in the face of tuning out, modern architecture, poets, movie makers, novelists, musicians, whatever, they sometimes cross over the line in being shocking just to get your attention. Just to have you listen and pay attention.
Where will it all end?
Well, who can tell?
I
like to think that there will be some kind of a reaction, and you will find places, maybe like the church, that begin to offer a refuge against all of that. I see the Eighth Commandment really at stake. The Eighth Commandment, dear friends, ta-da.
Not bear false witness.
You shall not bear false witness. You shall not bear false witness. Okay, let's move along. That's the contemporary spirit. As I say, it is now in disarray. It is now being challenged by the so-called postmodern sensibility, in which almost anything goes. I mean, you find neo-romantic, you find neo-gothic, you find neo-renaissance, you even find neo-Victorian. Well, the gingerbread coming back. New homes, new condominium townhouses in our city anyhow, with Victorian gingerbread in the front porch.
Same in Australia.
You saw it? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of bizarre in my view. Anyhow, moving along. Let us take a look now specifically at architecture. And let us ask, what are the basic architectural forms for a church? Well, there are two. You ought to read this book, Rudolf Schwarz, The Church Incarnate. He's a great European architect. I think he's dead now. But he writes a book and draws pictures of seven basic architectural forms for a church. and he has sacred chalice and sacred journey and all that. He has nice names for it, and he's kind of metaphysical about it. I mean, he's very philosophical. But basically, there are two kinds of churches, axial churches and radial churches. Axial is a strong central axis, and a lot of people are used to this kind of church and only this kind of a church. You give people a room of any dimension and ask them to make a church out of it, and they'll take a table, stick it against the small wall, the short wall, and rank up chairs like this. You know, that's what a church looks like, doesn't it? Well, that's like Gothic churches and some others, but it's not the only type of church. There is also this kind. This is radial, and you have the congregation gathered around a center. Both of them can speak of valid theology. I'm willing to admit that. Here's the theology of journey. We are like a mighty army, onward Christian soldiers. We are marching to the east. In the old days, the church was always facing the east, where the sun came up. As I say, armored Christian soldiers, the leaders are at the front of the ranks, and the soldiers are following, and we're marching to the New Jerusalem. So, you know, you could make an argument that that's okay. That speaks, I would say, of transcendence. A-N-C-E? Spelling is not my long suit. Transcendence. God is above us, beyond us, ahead of us, always somewhat other, capital O. This kind of a church arrangement speaks of transcendence. This kind of a church arrangement speaks of immanence. Martin Luther was very fond of immanence. Immanence. Ants? A-N-C-E?
E-N-E.
E-N?
Yeah, you're right.
E? Anyhow, immanence is God with us. You can find both in the Bible, transcendence and immanence. God ahead of us, beyond us, different from us, other than us, but also God with us. God in our midst, the word is near you. Remember Susan last night. Martin Luther loved to talk about the baby in the manger and the messy diapers and everything. I mean, he was very earthy. Here is God in this little tiny baby. So, I think this speaks of community as well, in a way that this does not. And further, this type of church has such strong associations with theater that I think we will have to abandon it. And I would argue that churches today ought to be, if not altogether axial, maybe half a circle.
Radial, you mean?
Radial, not axial, radial. Now, you might also have some kind of axis in here with a font here. You know, I mean, you can't do without some kind of axis, I think. And we're going to push the furniture around over here more like an axial, more like a radial church.
Aren't you defeating it? Why do you cut that in half? Why don't you go for the whole circle and get the concept across?
Yeah, you got some problems with a whole circle. It's kind of like leading a campfire if you're the pastor. You know, you always have somebody to your back.
Well, that's distracting to have the pastor keep turning around.
Yeah, right.
And well, I agree. We in our town, we had a big theater with the whole thing revolved.
Uh-huh.
The stage
kept
revolving.
Yeah. And you had the audience on all four sides?
Yeah, there was a theater in the round in California.
Theater in the round, yeah. More and more church buildings, more and more theaters are being built like that. More and more church buildings are being built like that. And for very good reasons, to make the people there feel participants. You see, here, you can sneak in the back door and sit in the back pew, and you're so far away from the action that, you know, you hardly have any commitment to the situation.
Right.
Here, you're almost compelled to be on stage. Right. And if you've been to Tyrone Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis or to Stratford in Ontario, there's a stage, those are theaters, where the stage is precisely like this. It's what they call a thrust stage. The building may be square or it may be six-sided or whatever, but the stage sticks out into the audience and the people sit on three sides. And more churches are being built like that. And in Europe, if you've been to the great cathedrals in Europe, you'll know that although they originally were very, very axial, Now, a typical cathedral would be built like a cross, as you may be aware, from the air. I mean, they had that specifically in mind when they built the buildings. Notre Dame, Chartres Cathedral, Reims, all those places are originally built like a cross. And this would be the chancel. The high altar would still be back near the back wall. There might be an apse here, a little round area. But more and more, they're remodeling those churches so as to build a platform in what's called the crossing, the transepts. And they sit chairs here and chairs here, in some cases even chairs here, altar here, and you've taken an axial building and turned it into a radial building. You see what I'm saying? Now, I affirm that. I think there's something to be said for that, which brings us to this, one room or two. Shall we build a church any longer that has a distinct nave and a distinct chancel? Does that suggest hierarchy? Does that suggest an unwholesome distinction between clergy and lay people? And more, modern architects, modern church people are saying, yes, that is something we should seek to avoid.
What word did you say, distinction? What kind?
A distinction between clergy and lay.
No.
Yes. That here, again, in the old time building with all the action up here, the chancel even had a screen in some instances. They had in the English churches what's called a rood screen, in the Greek Orthodox church an icon screen that was actually a solid wall with three little doors.
Well, the altar rail serves.
And even the altar rail, right. There are modern architects who are saying we should not have an altar rail. Now, it had original function to keep the dogs and the horses out of the holy place. But, you know, we don't have those problems anymore. So there are those who are saying, let's do without the altar rail. Let's even encourage people to stand to receive the Holy Communion instead of kneel. Because kneel is too humble. God does not want you to be that humble. We're going to talk about that on Wednesday. But that is gesture and action.
So the two rooms, nave and the...
Nave and chancel. Chancel is the other term. And again, in the English churches, let me just extend this drawing a little bit. Well, let me do it all over again. In the English cathedrals, you would have a very long chancel in a lot of cases, a round apse, then the transepts. Here would be the west end. There would be two big towers in the west end in Notre Dame and the French Gothic. In the English Gothic, there'd be a great big tower over the crossing. But here would be the altar, let's say, with a screen behind it. And so it would essentially be an east wall altar. Minister had to have the back to the people. And there would be choir pews like this for the monks or the nuns. And then there would be what's called a rood screen. And a rood screen would be a carved wood screen that separated the chancel from the hoi polloi, from the people. And again, if you were standing way in the back here, you could hardly see what was going on there. And you were not invited into the chancel if you were a layperson. And you may have seen churches, even in this country, that have a big sign here, please do not enter the chancel. You go to some new churches in Europe anyhow, and I see the sign, please enter the chancel and pray there. Valpo, any of you been to Valparaiso, the chapel there at Valparaiso University? Essentially, it's a new building, or that is, you know, modern in the contemporary spirit, but it is essentially a Gothic building. Long, narrow building, 20 steps, well, maybe 12 steps. Great.
That's huge.
Staircase between the nave level and the chancel. Big mistake.
Well, of course, the early Lutheran churches out on the prairies used to have a tower for the pastor.
Yes.
Steps up.
Yeah, right. It's three or four steps above criticism, as somebody says.
Oh, dear. Another church or chapel I would commend to you, Paul, is Christ Chapel at Gustavus Adolphus College.
Yes, that's a handsome little building, isn't it? Now, again, unfortunately, here they had the wonderful opportunity. When was that built? 1960?
Completed in, 61 was when it was first used. So
it's basically a square, but it's cockeyed, if I'm mistaken. I mean, isn't that true? You enter here and here, maybe even here and here, but the chancel is here. And if I'm not mistaken, there are pews like this, and pews like this, and they got an east wall altar. I mean, it's really a shame. That space, it seems to me, cries out to be radial. And I hope one of these days, they have a balcony in the back, isn't that right, up here? The back triangle is...
Actually, the side pews...
turn?
They are turned, yes. Uh-huh.
But I hope one of these days they rearrange. As a matter of fact, they have, when I've been there, they've taken a little portable table out and made it freestanding.
There's a church in Atlanta that's eight-sided.
Eight-sided, yeah.
Eight-sided. And it's not new.
The basic distinction is it radial or is it axial?
And they have the
I put a sign around axial. I didn't mean axial. I mean radial, don't I? Mm-hmm. Radial is what we should be building and not axial. Yeah. On the principle, if for no other reason than it looks so much, the axial buildings look so much like a theater, like an old-time theater.
They expect the pastor to perform.
Comments?
To make church going a spectator sport.
Yeah, exactly. Entertainment evangelism. You know, you put on a show for people. I don't think that's good.
Well, what we're stuck is they're all axial across America, all over the
country. Yeah, but they can be remodeled, and they can be, even without a lot of expense, you can remodel it. I served a church the last 18 months back in Waterloo, Ontario. Great, big, beautiful, new 1960 building, long and narrow, again, like a Gothic church, all the pews ranked up, east wall altar, great, big, huge, marble east wall altar, right against the wall, no chance to get behind it. And I brought out a table in the middle of the chancel, and I got on the other side. Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council, changed Roman Catholic worship around the world, overnight. I think it was Advent of 1963 when the Vatican Council's directives on liturgy and worship went into effect the first Sunday of Advent in 1963, and every Roman Catholic altar around the world came out from the wall. And the pastor now no longer turned the back on the people, but looked him in the face across the table. Which is the ancient way. I mean, that's the way the church used to be always in the old days. It's only in the Middle Ages when the east wall altar came in.
We did that Pope, small the church in California too.
Yeah,
moved it out.
Sure. The Pope in St. Peter's. St. Peter's was designed by Michelangelo, as you may know, and it's basically a Greek cross. Greek cross has four equal arms. This is the way Michelangelo designed it. From the sky, from the air. And the chancel is a huge chancel right here, this big, beautiful baldachin designed by Bernini, and the altar is right in the middle of it. I should say that a subsequent architect extended this arm, and then Bernini put the colonnade, and here's the fountain, and here's where the Pope speaks, from the window over here. Anyhow, if you've been in St. Peter's, it's a great, huge building. I mean, it's the biggest church in Christendom. But the Pope has always had a freestanding altar, and he has always presided from behind it, facing the people. So, we ought to do the same. And it's a pity that so many Lutheran church buildings are still not congenial to the priesthood of all believers. If you've got an east wall altar and an observable chancel, you got big problems. Now, they're not insurmountable. You can make do. But you long for the day when our Lutheran churches and Presbyterian and Methodist and all the other Protestants too look as good as most Roman Catholic churches do right now.
Course,
Roman Catholic churches
structures which lend itself more to being able to move
space, they have more space to move.
Right.
Around.
We have to make maybe more flexibility, more tempera. You know, tent and tabernacle. Pardon me, tabernacle tent means the same thing. Or temple. There's always been that conflict. Shall we build a building that's a temple, or shall we build a building that's a tabernacle, a tent? And the temple has its values, but there's some nice things about the tent, too. Flexible, expandable, movable, you know.
When did you say the Roman Catholics changed their...
I think it was 1963. in the middle of the Second Vatican Council, the Vatican Council affirmed the so-called Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, and at that moment, all masses around the world were now in the vernacular and the language of the people instead of Latin, and the pastor was behind the altar facing the people.
Did they have to move the altars?
Oh, sure. They had to do major architectural changes in a lot of buildings. And I'm saying we should, too. Do we have to quit? Not yet, do we? Let me just say, chief architectural signs. In a church building, you ought immediately to be able to pick out the chief architectural units, the chief architectural things. The font, the table or altar. Ambo is just a fancy word for pulpit or lectern, for preaching, reading. And there's only need for one place of the word. You don't need a pulpit and a lectern. Again, that's Gothic. Richard Kemmerer, any of you know him, wild man. He talks about church designed by Rorschach. you have to have one side of the church look exactly like the other side. Not necessary. There should be just one place to read the word and to preach the word. No sense whatever in having a pulpit and a lectern, in other words.
You had a pulpit, that's where the pastor and the gospel.
Right.
Lower class.
crazy. No need for that. Sedalia, that's a fancy word for seat, chair. And Gordon Lathrop says that the chair of the presider in the early church was maybe even more important than the table. The bishop sitting in his chair as the leader of the event. So you ought to see all of those four things. Font, table, ambo, and sedalia. What's that?
What is the ambo?
The ambo is the pulpit or lectern. It's ambo is a Greek word that means a raised space.
You're suggesting that the churches should have only one?
One place of the word, yeah. You know why we have two? Again, here's a little interesting thing. This comes out of Byzantine architecture. Any of you been to Ravenna in Italy? See those wonderful Ravenna basilicas? Very simple buildings. Again, on the grandiose side, kind of triumphalist. A row of columns here making an aisle. Unfortunately, a chancel with some stairs sometimes, and altar. In the old days, the church, the very first church building, these were the very first church buildings that were not house churches. There were house churches that had their own very simple domestic type of arrangements. Table in the middle, seat for the presider, in another room, a font for baptisms, and it was a dunking font. But the table in the room and the congregation was gathered around the table, like this. anyhow, the basilicas then were the first church buildings built as churches. And what they did is they used the Byzantine law court as a model. Not the world's best model, I don't think. A family dining room is a much better model, I think. But here was the altar for the god, who was the current god. Here were seats for the judges, and here was prosecuting and defense attorney. So that's why you have two pulpit and lectern, but you don't need two.
So the sedalia is where the presider is sitting, whoever.
Yes. Basilican position would be right behind the altar on a strong axis. You might have a font here. You have a strong east-west axis, font, altar, seat, and then the pulpit might be off to the side. What we're going to do this afternoon, for whatever it's worth, you can come and join me.
Take a look at our little plan here.
You only have one plan for a couple of you. You peer over people's shoulders. I want these back for this afternoon. My idea would be to put that platform with the table on it right in the middle, under that circular vent, right in the middle of the space. Arrange the chairs around it, and again, there'd be an axis, but the axis would be the short axis. Any of you seen Robert Schuller's Garden Grove, in Garden Grove, the Crystal Cathedral?
Yeah.
Any of you been there? It's a building like this, like a diamond shape. And the main aisle is in the short axis. Not the long axis, but the short axis. Here's the chancel again. You have an altar over here, believe it or not. You never see it on TV. Here's the pulpit with Robert Schuller's smiling face and the greens behind it. And here's a big organ. And then here, on the second floor, is balconies with rows like this, and the Spanish trumpets on Chamad shooting here. You put his television camera here and shoot across here, it looks like there are thousands of people there. I think there are, as a matter of fact, 2,000. But downstairs, they're sitting like this. And here's a font, believe it or not. They don't call it a font, but it's a great big long fountain, bubbling. So, you know, in some ways it's a very traditional church. Anyhow, what I want to do is put the font here, altar in the middle, and then ambo under the cross, you might say. And the seats gathered around as indicated.
Why do you need a sedalia?
Pardon?
Why do you need a sedalia? I mean, why is that important?
Well, because the people ought to be able to see the leader. The leader doesn't do anybody a favor if he or she is hiding.
Yes,
you know what I mean? You ought to be able to see.
Even what they're not performing.
Yes, because the people take their cue from the leader. The leader stands, everybody else stands. The leader sits, everybody else sits. The leader kneels, everybody else kneels. So a good leader, I think, ought to be visible. That's why
the whole time.
I would say the whole time. Now, they solved it the other night, last night, and they just sat in for a pew. And I suppose that would do. But I think I would still like, and I think I will provide.
It's hard to know who's going to be the leader.
Pardon?
Last night, it was a little difficult to know
who was the leader. Yeah, exactly.
Which one of the casting characters.
I mean, lots of people were in charge, but that's another part of the demonstration.
The priesthood of all believers, right, and that's an important recovery. You see, again, that's also part of Vatican II. In 1963, on the first Sunday of Advent, lay people are reading the scripture, they're serving, leading the prayers, they're handing out the communion, bread and wine. You know, all of those were marvelous changes. Again, that affected Roman Catholicism deeply, so much so that a lot of old-time Roman Catholics go, oh, gee, this isn't the church that I'm used to, with the Latin Mass that I couldn't understand. You know, I mean, people say, I know what I like. They really should say, I like what I know. I like what I'm familiar with. And it may be terrible what they're familiar with, but they like it, right? I mean, that's human. And I think we ought to try to change people's piety. That's really what you're doing here, is changing their piety, and that's always difficult. And you want to do it very pastorally and very sensitively and very gently, but I think you have a responsibility to change people's piety. And when we change the room around like this, as we will this afternoon, we're inviting people to change their piety.
Paul, two short questions. Where do you see the Bible? Sitting on the altar or on
the altar is the place for the meal, the bread and the cup. So the Bible ought to be on the ambo.
Right.
The pulpit, the lectern.
And
the New Roman Catholic churches, again, are sometimes providing a little kind of a shrine in the front of the pulpit where the book is on display, either open or closed. But they'll have a little niche in the front that faces the people. Mm-hmm. But you could also put it and keep it permanently on the mm-hmm.